morning or good afternoon, depending upon where you are joining us from. My name is Kim Bernhardt, and I am the moderator for today's Lancaster House audio program as part of its summer 2016 series. I am a labor arbitrator and mediator, and I am also a part-time member on the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario. My former law practice focused upon labor, employment, and human rights law. As many of us are settlers on this land, it is our collective responsibility to recognize our colonial histories and present-day implications and to honor, protect, and sustain this land. Today I am speaking to you from Oakville, Ontario, land that was initially inhabited by the Anishinaabe, who came to be known as the Mississaugas, and I wish to pay respect to both the land and to the First Peoples of this land. Today's audio conference is entitled Ensuring Equality at Work for Aboriginal Peoples, addressing the workplace recommendations, or as we now know them, the calls to actions of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And we are honored to welcome an extremely knowledgeable and qualified group of four presenters for today's session. First, we will hear from the Honorable Senator Murray Sinclair, who chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or as you'll probably hear during the course of the call, TRC. Senator Sinclair served the justice system in Manitoba for over 25 years and was the first Aboriginal judge appointed in Manitoba and Canada's second Aboriginal judicial appointment. He served as co-chair of the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry in Manitoba. He has served as an adjunct professor of law at the University of Manitoba. Senator Sinclair has been very active within his profession and his community and has won a number of awards, including the National Aboriginal Achievement Award, the Manitoba Bar Association's Equality Award, and its Distinguished Service Award. He has received eight honorary doctorate degrees from eight Canadian universities. Senator Sinclair will provide us some of the background to and the impetus for some of the TRC's calls to actions, as well as how the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples might affect Canadian employment and labor relations. Senator Sinclair's time is limited, so we don't know how much time he'll be able to stay with us after his remarks, but we have an impressive group of three panelists that will follow his remarks. Kelly Serbu has been an adjudicator with the Indian Residential Schools Adjudication Secretariat since 2008. He is a part-time commissioner with the Canadian Human Rights Commission, all in addition to his constitutional, criminal, and personal injury civil litigation law practice. He resides and works in Nova Scotia, where he also finds time for presenting at legal conferences and workshops, as well as working within his community and coaching youth hockey and soccer. But Senator Sinclair, could we get a greeting from you so that we can identify your voice?
Yes, good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, wherever you might be.
Thank you. And Kelly, how about yourself?
And likewise, good morning or good afternoon to everyone, wherever you might be.
Thank you both. We are also fortunate to have Michael Ballard, National Human Rights Representative, Union of Environment Workers, and BC Male Representative, National Aboriginal People's Circle of the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Michael is a fishery officer and currently the Acting Detachment Supervisor within the Conservation and Protection Branch at Fisheries and Oceans Canada. Michael is an executive member of his union and sits as the National Human Rights Representative for the Union of Environmental Workers, and he's a co-founder and BC Male Representative on the Public Service Alliance of Canada's National Aboriginal People's Circle. Michael has also served as chair of the department's Regional Diversity Advisory Committee for more than 10 years and was appointed to the Chairs and Champions Committee as an Aboriginal representative, heading up the Retention and Advancement Subcommittee. Michael has been an activist advocating for Indigenous rights for more than 20 years, both within and outside of the federal public service. Welcome to the audio conference, Michael. Michael?
Yes, thanks, Kim, and good morning, everybody. I'm in Vancouver, and it's still morning here.
Very good. Our third panelist is Bronwyn Waters, Deputy Minister, Department of Human Resources of the Government of the Northwest Territories. Bronwyn has been an educator, serving as a special education coordinator for the government of the Northwest Territories. During her 4 years in the Department of Education, she worked in schools throughout the Northwest Territories. In 1982, Bronwyn joined the Department of Social Services as Director of Social Programs, beginning 31 years in senior management. Her positions have included Director of Policy, Legislation, Communications, and Human Resources in Health and Social Services and Justice, as well as being the ADM in Social Services and Justice. Bronwyn ultimately retired as Deputy Minister of Justice in 2002. However, following her retirement, she served as a commissioner with the Territory's Human Rights Commission and was the executive lead for the Territorial Anti-Poverty Initiative. She returned to the Territories as Deputy Minister of Human Resources in 2015. Welcome to the audio conference, Bronwyn.
Thank you, and hello, everyone. And could I just say, I didn't retire until 2012, not 2002, just aged me by 10 years.
My apologies. I misread.
Sometimes I hear it.
With this very distinguished, dedicated, and experienced panel, let me outline today's program. A few words of introduction to our topic. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada provided employment-related calls to action in its final report. One suggestion is that public servants and management and employees in the private sector receive education on the history and culture of Aboriginal peoples and on the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It recommended that such education includes skills-based training in intercultural competency, conflict resolution, human rights, and anti-racism. The Commission also called on Canada's businesses to ensure that Aboriginal people have equitable access to jobs, training, and education opportunities in the corporate sector. Our panel of experts will be discussing how public and private sector employers and unions can implement these calls to actions. We have a lot of material to go through today, and we will have a select amount of time on each of the sub-issues in our topic as laid out in the index to the materials, and we will spend the next 80 minutes or so discussing each of them in turn. I know that many of you will have questions for the speakers on these topics, so I'm going to slot two question and answer sessions in during the conference. The first will be in about 35 minutes from now, and the second will be near the end of the audio conference. I will allow about 5 to 6 minutes on each of these two occasions, and whenever we are about to approach the first question and answer period, I'll explain how you can pose your question directly to one of the speakers. And one final point before we begin. Lancaster House is a member of the Human Resource Professional Association, and it provides continuing professional development hours to human resources professionals who partake in Lancaster's conferences and audios. At the end of today's audio conference, I will provide the program's ID number for the benefit of the human resources professionals who are looking to acquire recertification points. We shall now start today's audio conference with an overview of the background to the TRC's calls to action, and you can see a lot of this material on pages 8 to 50 of the link that Lancaster House provided you for materials. Senator Sinclair, may I begin with you. Could you give us some of the impetus behind the TRC's calls to actions, in particular those related to employment? Why is this necessary?
Well, thank you, and hello to all. I wanted to begin by just thanking you for allowing me to be part of this discussion, and I regret that I can't stay throughout, but I'll contribute what I can. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established to give a complete history of the residential school system in Canada and also to show the legacies of the residential schools and what that meant to us as commissioners, and ultimately was accepted to by all of the parties to the settlement agreement, was that we were to look at the current situation that Indigenous people have and the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and see what connections could be made between those relationships or those conditions and the residential school experience. And the first thing that we identified was that the residential school experience was really part of an overall policy relating to Indigenous people from the time of Confederation that was essentially a very negative approach on the part of the federal government that permeated throughout the thinking of society at large. And what we pointed out was that Indigenous children were taken away from their families at very young ages for about seven generations and placed into institutions called residential schools. And while in those residential schools, they were subjected to an institutional lifestyle which deprived them of the natural affection and natural relationship that they would have had in a family environment and in a normal community environment. And in addition to all of that, of course, they were subjected to harsh discipline and in some cases physical and sexual abuse. About 40% of those who were alive at the time the settlement agreement was signed have filed claims for those abuses. But the important thing, I think, for people to understand is that the institutionalization of children from a very young age until they were young adults had a dramatic impact upon their ability to cope with life's challenges, including raising their own families. And that perpetuated from generation to generation. And the strength of the family bond deteriorated with each passing generation. All of that was in an overall environment in which the government of Canada took a very hostile attitude towards Indigenous culture generally, because not only were laws passed to enforce the residential school system, but laws were also passed to make it illegal for Indigenous people to govern themselves in accordance with their traditions, to be able to practice their cultures, to be able to gather, to be able to protest, to be able to vote, and to be able to gain access to the justice system in order to challenge all of these things. Eventually, that impact was reflected, I think, in the communities where the people came from. And part of the weakening of the social bonds that we identified that related back to the residential school experience as well as the overall experience of Indigenous people in Canada was that the ability of Indigenous leaders and communities to be able to make their own decisions and do their own things in accordance with their own customs was weakened by the interference of government agents, including Indian agents, as well as police officers, social workers, etc. Now, the attitude that the teachers in the schools took towards Indigenous children were to convince them that they were inferior people, that they came from an inferior culture, that their languages could not be spoken and could not be retained, that their practices of faith and their cultural traditions had to be abandoned, and they had to move into a different lifestyle. And that, of course, was reinforced by some of the legislation I mentioned earlier that was enforced outside of the residential schools. But the very same attitudes were also spoken about and taught in the public schools of Canada as well, from the moment that public schools became part of the Canadian approach to education. And so non-Indigenous children being raised in Canada were also educated to believe that Indigenous people were inferior, that their cultures were inferior and irrelevant, that they lacked a civilization, that they lacked a proper form of faith and belief systems, and that they were lucky that the Europeans came along and saved them from extinction. This idea that Indigenous people were on the verge of extinction was a very popular one at the end of the 19th century. And it perpetuated itself in various policies going forward. And you often see government officials in Parliament and elsewhere speaking about the need to save and protect the Indians. The end result is that Indigenous people in the residential schools and even those who went to public schools and the non-Indigenous children who went to public schools were taught to believe in Indigenous inferiority. And we're also taught to believe in the myth of European superiority. And that had an impact upon their attitude towards each other and had an impact upon the Indigenous children's attitude towards themselves as well and their families and their communities. And because there was very little recourse for them, they had no option but to accept that, they couldn't go to court, they couldn't access any other sources of information. And our point in leading to the calls to action that we established were that we need to understand, therefore, that the way that we talk to and about each other has been impacted by this very lengthy history of 150 years or so of people believing in this state of affairs, and that that has an impact upon our relationships in society, but also has an impact in the workplace. And people who are trying to access the workplace from the indigenous community, the corporate environment, are hampered by the fact that they are perceived in a certain way and sometimes are limited in the opportunities that are provided to them because of the perception that other people have of them and have of their lifestyle, or have of the lifestyle of indigenous people generally. And that there has in fact been created in this society two solitudes, indigenous people and non-indigenous people being incapable of speaking to each other and about each other in a fair and just way. And so what we said in the report is that we need to recognize that and we need to address it as we go forward. And part of it is in all of the social institutions, the government institutions, including education, social services, and the justice system, but also in the private sector as well. And that's why we address the need for the private sector to also take on responsibility to do something about this when it comes to its indigenous employees.
Wow. Senator Sinclair, thank you very much for that overview. And that's an awful lot of content to be delivered in such a short period of time, I'm sure, since the
Well, if you want the full story, we have a 5,000-page report that you can read. But
I know, and I understand, and the summary is a good chunk as well.
Yeah, the summary is only 400 pages, so it's a little easier.
Well, we're going to focus in on that workplace to assist people in that specific area today. And I was wondering if you could give us a little bit more specific outline on just how inequitable the current access to jobs, training, and education opportunities are for Aboriginal peoples in, let's call it, the corporate or the private sector.
Well, there's first of all, there's the relationship between the private sector and Indigenous people generally, I think, that suffers from a lack of respect on the part of the private industry. And that's changing, mind you, but it certainly has been a state of affairs for a lengthy period of time. For example, the issue of Indigenous rights over land, Indigenous rights to resources, Indigenous or Aboriginal title, as it's come to be called in the courts, and the treaty rights, are so misunderstood in the broader Canadian society that people tend to dismiss them as being valid rights or valid areas of concern. And so the result is that when those things come up in conversation, while there's a very serious approach being taken to it on the part of the Indigenous side, there's a bit less serious approach and a more dismissive approach being taken to it on the non-Indigenous side. And we've seen that for years in the resource industries, petroleum, forest, mining, who believe that they don't have to talk to Indigenous people when it comes to their particular end of the work, that they only need to get permits from government, and it's up to government to deal with those issues. And more we've been seeing the courts recently saying to society, but also to the corporate world, that before you start mining, before you start cutting timber, before you start digging into the ground to access petroleum resources, you have to ensure that you understand whether or not there is a traditional right over that land. There's an Aboriginal title issue that you need to address. And if there is, then you have a duty to consult with the people who are affected by your actions. And in a recent decision went so far as to say, in some cases, you need to get their consent. So that has an impact upon the private world. But also for those who are employed within the private sector, we have found in the course of the interviews that we conducted with Indigenous people over the many years of the TRC, that there were many people who talked about coming into an environment of negativity, of people who believed that Indigenous people were unclean, were addicted, were impossible to employ, that they were unreliable, and that they didn't have the ability to be able to function above a certain level. And so you can almost see that reflected in the practices of the private sector over the years, in the public sector too, but we're talking about the private sector for now, where most Indigenous people, vast majority of Indigenous people, are employed at the lower level, entry-level positions. And when it comes to people moving into management and above, the movement rate is not as great. That's beginning to change because more and more Indigenous people are getting higher education. But initially, there was a favoritism that was shown towards non-Indigenous people by non-Indigenous employers. And that is something that we say we need to begin to address, and by providing for more equitable employment situations within the work environment. And part of it begins with understanding this history and understanding the impact that this history not only has had upon Indigenous people, but understanding the impact that this history has had upon the non-Indigenous people as well, including the employers.
Right, of course. Is it any better in this public sector? Let's go.
Well,
there.
In the public sector, you see more, I think, more recognition that the public sector has an obligation to approach these things more fairly. But from the experiences that we heard from the residential school survivors and their family members, there was still a feeling, and still a significant feeling, that the work environment can be very negative, and that there's a sense of hostility when Indigenous people are brought in, that they're not competent, that they're brought in as favoritisms, or they're being brought in through some form of employment equity program, and they don't have the same skills that others have. Even though they might be quite capable to perform the job, they're treated as though they're not capable. The result is that for a lot of Indigenous employees, they have to prove themselves constantly. For non-Indigenous employees, they're given a lot more leeway. So that attitude is part of the problem, but it's also the distrust that Indigenous employees feel that they are treated with when it comes to being placed in a situation of decision-making. To give you an example of that, during the OCA crisis, we heard from Indigenous employees who worked for the media that they were not allowed to go and report on the OCA crisis because their employers said they would not be able to give a fair media report of what was going on. But they never questioned the fact that the non-Indigenous employees, who were also, of course, affected by what was going on, could give a fair report. And so it's that kind of attitude that we saw and continue to see in some places in the private sector that still needs to be addressed.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn to the potential impact of international agreements on the workplace situation for Indigenous peoples in Canada. How, if at all, does the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples affect labor, employment, or human rights law that applies to employers, unions, and employees in Canadian jurisdictions?
Well, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is a leading document when it comes to transforming the relationship between Indigenous people and the societies in which they exist, because it calls upon nation states and governments to undertake to do certain things and to undertake to respond to the consequences of their own past behaviors. And so that's quite an obligation that's being imposed upon governments. It effectively says to them, listen, you've been messing things up for a long time, and as a result, you've created these terrible social situations and conditions and relationships, and now you have an obligation to fix them. The obligation is not on the part of indigenous people to comply. The obligation is on the part of governments to stop requiring compliance and start, in fact, doing the right thing. So the UN Declaration is an important document for people to be familiar with. And it's an educational tool in and of itself simply to learn about it, because it identifies almost all of those areas where action needs to be taken. And so we've said the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is a framework for reconciliation going forward, because if it is understood and if the spirit of it, even if just the spirit of it, is implemented in not just the workplace but in social policy and legislation, then it will be transformative in terms of the way things will happen in the future. But in terms of what it calls upon government to do, and it calls upon the private sector and governments at all levels, including provincial and municipal, it calls upon people to change their behavior and to address certain things specifically. So, as an example, institutions that have spent their entire existence undermining indigenous culture, indigenous languages, indigenous customs and practices need to make a commitment to stop doing that, but also need to make a commitment to be supportive to correcting that and to repairing the consequences of that.
I have one final question for you specifically, and that is that in order to bring life to the UN obligations, I understand there's been a private member's bill, Bill C-262, and
yes,
it's titled An Act to Ensure that the Laws of Canada Are in Harmony with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Will this have an impact in terms of some of the suggestions you were just making for Aboriginal peoples in Canada?
Well, if it becomes the law of the country, then what it'll do is it'll obligate Canada and other jurisdictions as well, because it will be a law that that Canada as a federal government can enforce as against other entities. But it'll become a law which requires that existing legislation that is currently in place has to meet the test of compliance with the UN Declaration, not only in terms of the spirit of it, but also in terms of the specifics of the UN Declaration. Now, keep in mind, incidentally, that in international law, declarations are not in the same state as state of legal enforceability as treaties or conventions and other kinds of international instruments. A declaration is what people often refer to as an aspirational document, which means that these are directions that we call upon governments to aspire to meet. And the Canadian government, when they first adopted the UN Declaration, insisted upon everybody understanding that it's only an aspirational document and they were not committing to implementing it. This government, since the election of October of last year, has indicated that they are prepared to look at implementing the UN Declaration. And the beginning of that, in my view, and when the Member of Parliament, Romeo Saganash, who introduced the bill in the House, put it forward, I joined him in a press conference and said this is the first step. The first step is to do an analysis of existing legislation to see what legislation is in place now that is inconsistent with the UN Declaration, and let's identify that and let's begin to take steps to correct that.
Sweeping changes might be coming, and certainly not quickly, given our past.
Well, I've said in the past that getting to the truth was hard. Getting to understand the impact of residential school was a difficult, painful process. But getting to reconciliation is going to be even harder.
Yes, I'm glad we started. Senator Sinclair, I do know that you might have to leave us fairly soon. And so if that's the case, on behalf of us on this panel, Lancaster House, and those participating in today's audio conference, I really want to thank you for sharing your time and valued insights with us. So please do stay on for as long as you can, but I didn't want to miss the opportunity to acknowledge your contribution and thank you for it.
All right, I'll be staying on for a few more minutes until my next call that I have to take comes through. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I will now check in with our remaining panelists for any further comments about the TRC report, employment-related calls to actions, and the potential impact of the UN's declaration. Kelly, starting with you, what are your thoughts about the TRC calls to action, in particular given your advocacy work with youth and experiences with issues brought to the Canadian Human Rights Commission?
A couple points I'd start with. First of all, I believe that the National Human Rights Institution, the NRIs, can also assist in the implementation of the UN Declaration by operating as a bridge between the international human rights system and the on-the-ground reality experienced by indigenous peoples. In addition, the education functions of NHRIs can help raise awareness of indigenous peoples' human rights and how they may be exercised. As an example, the CHRA includes a number of provisions that assist in promoting and protecting Indigenous human rights. For example, the interpretive and non-derogation clauses and Section 16 of the special measures. In particular, the Canadian Human Rights Commission has established an initiative called the National Aboriginal Initiative, which is a focal point within the Commission to better promote and protect the rights of Indigenous peoples. The Commission has also developed an Aboriginal Employment Preferences Policy. I apologize for my voice. I think I'm losing it. But anyway, those would be my comments to add to the comments of Senator Sinclair.
We appreciate that and hope that you can retain your voice at least for another hour or so.
Myself as well.
Michael, your thoughts, in particular from your position within a unionized environment.
Well, I think unions have a strong role to play in pushing governments to, you know, do the right thing to answer to these calls. In particular, there's articles within the calls to action that, in my workplace in the Federal Public Service, require education around various aspects of the residential school impacts, the legacy they've left behind, and helping others understand in the workplace what that what those challenges are for our Indigenous employees. The union also can play a strong role once we start to work towards ratifying or having Romeo Saginaw's 262 passed next year. We can start working to develop collective agreements that have mechanisms built in to respect and enable full participation of Indigenous communities in federal public service in particular. We do play a strong role now, but I think if we had the legislative framework, we could certainly play a much stronger role in the future.
Are there examples out there, Michael, of things you've been involved with, particularly, I'd say, in terms of union education that have happened so far?
Well, we have. The Public Service Alliance of Canada, as you know, we have a National Aboriginal People's Circle. We've developed leadership training for our Indigenous members, and we've built networks throughout the country in our seven regions. We've developed a women's leadership training for Indigenous women. We've worked in the regions to roll that training out for various departments. Unfortunately, PSAC is only a bargaining unit for about a third of federal public servants, so other unions need to also come on board and provide those same sorts of leadership training and those sorts of training initiatives for their members as well.
Thank you. And Bronwyn, anything to add from your experience, particularly from your position as a key employer within the territorial government?
It's a bit hard to follow up on some rather impressive speakers, but certainly from our perspective in the Northwest Territories, the TRC report very much resonated with our own experience. Many of the things that Senator Sinclair referenced were things that we were experiencing. You know, we saw the effects of the generational alienation from families, the inability to parent, and how it affects every aspect of society. One thing in particular that Senator Sinclair said that really, really resonated with me was the comment about the two solitudes. And as an employer, you see it in the workplace, sometimes very subtly, sometimes not so subtle. One specific example that I vividly remember from a number of years ago was two young female employees, one Indigenous, one non-Indigenous. Both separately came to me in tears. They had been having a disagreement, and the non-Indigenous person came to me and she said, "I can't talk to her, she's rude. When I try to talk to her, she walks away." The Indigenous young woman said, I don't know what to do. She keeps confronting me. I don't want the confrontation." And, you know, the difference in the two cultures was so vivid and so apparent. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, this is just sort of a tiny, tiny capsule, just two people with one specific argument, but it really seemed to encapsulate that concept of the two solitudes that through, you know, training, through exposure, through understanding, we need to bridge. And as employers, we need to bridge it so that we can have productive workplaces that go beyond just being free from harassment and discrimination, that are actually understanding and people can work together really effectively.
So in your view, do you think the call to action that specifically deals with the workplace being educated as to the history of these differences would have assisted in that example?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's not sufficient in and of itself, but it goes a long way, and it is essential. It's an essential component.
Thank you. I will now turn to the second part of our materials, which focuses specifically on the systemic nature of discrimination against Indigenous peoples. This focuses primarily on Section 3, which is found at pages 51 to 104 of the materials. Kelly, we're going to put your voice to the test, so I'll begin with you. Could you please outline for us how workplace parties can identify systemic discrimination or institutional racist behavior against Indigenous peoples? And add to that, what is required to prove or disprove systemic discrimination at a human rights tribunal or at an arbitration?
Okay, thank you very much. The materials prepared by Lancaster House are very informative. There's a lot of cases, a lot of reports, a lot of expert or, I guess, articles by various renowned authors, so I'm not going to refer to a lot of quotes. The materials are there for the readers. Some key messages I'd like to, I guess, point out are the dynamics of discrimination in organizations have become subtle, and systemic discrimination is often embedded in seemingly neutral policies, procedures, practices, and organizational structures. The most common approach to identifying systemic discrimination is to look at inequalities in outcomes between groups. However, statistics are have limitations. Responsible managers within organizations can identify systemic discrimination or an institutional racist behavior by examining their internal policies and processes and their organizational culture. There's one case that wasn't mentioned within the Lancaster material, and I'll provide the site at the end of the call, but it's CNR versus Action, and my French is very poor. Travailler de Femme. In that case, the Supreme Court of Canada defines systemic discrimination as follows. Systemic employment context discrimination that results from a simple operation of established procedures of recruitment, hiring, promotion. The discrimination is then reinforced by the very exclusion of the disadvantaged group because the exclusion fosters the belief both within and outside the group that the exclusion is a result of natural forces. For example, that woman just can't do the job. The most common approach to identify systemic discrimination is to study inequalities in outcomes between groups. Tools such as training and workforce analysis instruments developed by the labor programs can help employers identify gaps in the representation and fulfill their obligations under the Employment Equity Act. However, statistics have limitations, as I previously said. It is somewhat difficult to take and look at those, and one must also consider other multiple factors that may result in inequalities, and there is a possibility that the disparities may be attributes to discrimination can be explained by some other causes. So that case, and again, I said I'll give the site for it later, is, I think, very informative. What is required to prove or disprove systemic discrimination at a human rights tribunal? Some key messages on that point, I would say, are the following. There are three indicators that tribunals can look at to identify the existence of systemic discrimination: numerical data, policies and practices, and the organizational culture. First, dealing with numerical data, such as statistics, is the first indicator. For example, when people of a certain group are not represented fairly in some employment sectors, as outlined above, it shows in the data. Systemic discrimination is often not subtle, is often more subtle, and it can be involuntarily and a result of inadequate policy or practice. Employment equity audits can uncover systemic issues. Systemic discrimination often has deeper historical and complex roots. The disadvantages faced by Indigenous peoples in various sectors can result in systemic discrimination in employment and unequal opportunities. What do you need to, and I think part of the question as well was about expert evidence. Do you need expert evidence to prove it before the tribunal? Some key messages on that. Generally, in systemic discrimination cases, the evidence presented to a tribunal must be wide-ranging, incredible, and it can include witnesses with personal experiences, statistical evidence, as well as experts who are unable to accurately analyze and provide information and provide explanations to the decision maker. In particular, with respect to expert evidence, what I would say is, not like any other tribunal or before any type of trier of fact, if a party wants to call expert evidence to support his or her case, I would suggest, you know, as a lawyer and as an advocate, make sure that you know your facts, make sure your facts are going to be supportive, and they're going to, I guess, bolster the evidence of the expert evidence. Also, that the expert evidence that you're looking to lead is something that the trier of fact actually needs help on. So there's the case of R versus Mohan, which isn't in the Lancaster material, but it's a seminal case which deals with expert evidence and basically sets up the test before a party can call and lead expert evidence and what the expert will actually testify to. The last, I think, part of the question which was before me was dealt with the relationship between individual and systemic complaints of discrimination. Some key messages on that, I would say, would be that biases and stigma can exist in the workplace at both the individual and organizational level. When individual discriminatory behaviors such as marginalization or harassment are tolerated and encouraged, the discrimination can expand to the whole organization. So,
Thank you, sir.
Would be my comments on what you originally asked.
Thank you very much, Kelly. Appreciate that. Michael, do you agree with Kelly's comments? Anything else you'd like to highlight?
Kelly, can you say that again?
I was asking for
I
your
comments. I like you already.
No. Yes, I agree. And I think when I think about some of the staffing practices and some of the systemic barriers that we have built into our hiring practices, that's one thing. You know, those are they're fairly easy to identify. But when we talk about numerical data in order to support analysis of inequalities or outcomes, I think that's the problem there. Because in my experience, particularly when I was working as the chair of our Regional Diversity Advisory Committee, what I found was it's a moving target. You know, we have right now, in particular, our Statistics Canada's capacity has been diminished to the point of almost dysfunction. We've changed the process for collecting census data from a long-form mandatory long-form to a voluntary household survey, which was a was not very successful in terms of getting the replies or the responses back that they'd hoped to. So the data wasn't very accurate, particularly huge areas of northern Ontario due to the fires that were occurring at the time. There's the change to labor force availability formulas housed within the Public Service Commission that we can't, it seems to be a bit of a moving target as well. So when we talk about numerical analysis, I think we need to have some consistent data sets that we can rely on over time in order to look for changes and assess outcomes. And that's been, to me, one of the biggest problems. We can certainly identify systemic barriers built into staffing practices. And then, you know, looking at the culture of organizations, we can see whether or not they're supportive or not. Those are challenging things to change, but they're certainly easy to access just by looking at, you know, how people are treated in the workplace. The Public Service Employment Surveys, which is done by Federal Public Service, indicates, you know, fairly clearly that there's areas where we can focus and make a lot of improvements. And there are tools, and there's a collection of best management practices that are being developed. But for me, when I look at all these case law, and thank you, Lancaster House, for all the material, the one thing that stands out to me is either there's an incorrect process in terms of how the hiring was conducted, because the spirit of the organization was there to do the hiring properly, but they just didn't put a proper process in place that was defensible. So the challenge comes. And then the other thing I see is there's a conflict with the negotiated collective agreements between the existing legislation and those collective agreements, which gives the opportunity to defeat what would be normally an affirmative action towards addressing representation gaps. So there's lots of things we can do, but I think the biggest thing we can do is stabilize the data set so that we can analyze these things correctly.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. Bronwyn, as an employer, do you agree with Kelly's and or Michael's outline of systemically discriminatory practices and how they're identified and or proven disproved?
I certainly agree with most of it. I guess I come at it from a slightly different perspective, simply because I don't have to look at it on a very sort of broad national scale. I'm looking at it from the perspective of a single public service in the Northwest Territories. I think Kelly's point about inequalities, systemic discrimination rather, being identified by inequalities in the outcomes is really, really important. I think that's key to how we determine if there are, because sometimes the discrimination can be very subtle. Michael was talking about staffing practices, which I think, you know, I agree with him, are critical. And here, you know, again, if you look at the outcomes, from my perspective, is looking at the single jurisdiction, our hiring practices seem very fair. You know, everybody's subjected to the same, you know, the same process, the questions are standardized, everything is equal, but the outcome isn't equal. The goal of the Northwest Territories is to have a representative workforce, which means that our workforce reflects on a proportional basis the population that it serves, which should be approximately 50% Indigenous. It isn't. It's approximately 32% Indigenous. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. So what is the difference? And so you look at, you have to go beyond sort of the apparent and look at what's underlying it. And certainly when you look at staffing practices, it can be in the job descriptions themselves. And one of the things that we are looking at doing, and that I think is an important approach, is to review the job descriptions to see if there are systemic barriers built in, such as credentials. We know that, you know, we have the evidence that says that, you know, the indigenous population do not have the same levels of education as the non-indigenous, and that's across Canada. So is it fair to require a specific credential for positions where really it's not the credential that counts, it's the competency?
Right.
So moving to competencies and away from credentials, I think, can go a long way to helping sort of level, make the staffing process fairer to, certainly to Indigenous people and other people who may not have the same access to education. And this, you know, as we know from the TRC report, we have generations of Indigenous children who were not able to access education at the same level as non-Indigenous children. So we know there's a systemic barrier. Let's do what we can to get rid of it.
Thank you very much, all of you, for your comments on the systemic cases as well as systemic barriers that and hurdles that are there to be overcome. Kelly, back to you. Looking at the remedies, what can be sought as a result of proven systemic discrimination, and how are the orders enforced and how effective are they?
Okay. So some of the key messages with respect to remedies, the objective of human rights legislation is remedial. It is intended to make whole the person who has experienced discrimination. There is an obligation on the party who has been discriminated against to mitigate the effects of the discriminatory practice where possible. Financial remedies may be awarded to an individual for the recovery of lost wages or associated costs resulting from discrimination. Systemic discrimination requires systemic remedies, which may be in the form of special action orders, orders of policy changes or anti-discrimination training. And I think the next part of the question you're asking about, how are these orders enforced? Key message on that, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunals set a time limit in which remedial orders should be carried out, and in some cases it may indicate it will remain seized for a period of time, such as 6 months or a year. When the CHRT has made an order and the respondent refuses to comply with the order, the complainant can register the tribunal's order with the federal court under Rule 424 of the federal court rules and ask that the court enforce the order at that point. Also, under the CHRA, there are a number of provisions. So if you were to look under Section 53, in particular Section 53, Sub 2, Sub A, that tribunal may order the person cease the discriminatory practice and take measures. Under 53.2 sub B, also allows the tribunal to order that the person make available to the victim of the discriminatory practice the rights, opportunities, and privileges that were being denied or that they weren't entitled to. 53.2 C provides compensation of any wages that the person who is discriminated against was deprived of. And then there are some other orders that the court can make as well. In particular, a lot of times when the tribunal is looking at systemic discrimination and looking to make orders, a lot of the focus is on public interest remedies ordered by human rights tribunals. And these are meant to have an impact on the broader community, including other people who could have been affected by the discrimination. The impact can be education or in the form of corrective action. Public interest remedies give other potential respondents and the general public a greater understanding of the discrimination and are often intended to to prevent similar discrimination from happening in the future.
So how effective have these orders been in terms of advancing equality of Aboriginal peoples in the workplace? So in Ontario, I think many of us are familiar with what we call the McKinnon case, an Aboriginal jail guard, and it went on for many years, and there were many public interest remedies. What's your view of the effectiveness of some of these systemic remedies?
honestly, cases are one thing. I mean, you get a case, you read it, you see what the systemic discrimination was, you see the court found it, the court made an order. In the McKinnon case, I think if you follow the timeline of that case, it went on for 18 years.
Over 20, I believe.
Was it over 20?
I think so, yeah.
So anyway, I think really you'd have to ask the parties involved and affected about, okay, well, at the end of it, did this actually make any change within your workplace? It's one thing for a tribunal to say, okay, cease and desist the behavior that you're engaging in, and we want you to implement these, you know, educational programs to educate other members. But, you know, an order is one thing. So whether or not someone complies with it, whether or not they're actually going to buy into it. So someone, you know, saying and doing that, you know, they're following a program doesn't necessarily mean that the discrimination is going to vanish and go away.
Right.
This is something that's deep-rooted, that's over time. So you have, you know, I think it's very difficult. I think you'd really have to ask the affected parties. I don't think I'd be the proper person to comment on whether or not, you know, did the tribunal make a difference in your situation? And I think a lot of times it's going to take, you know, many years for you actually to see that outcome. So you're going to see people who were in that, you know, the roles that were part of the process that led to the complaint in the first place. You're going to see whoever was affected with that no different than the intergenerational effects of residential schools. It's going to take a number of years for that to actually wash away what the harm had been done, and, you know, grow new roots and have people educated and treat people the way they should be with respect.
Fair enough. Okay, Michael, as someone who actually is involved with those, the unionized members who face these things, have you found there to be systemic remedies that have been effective in advancing more equality for Indigenous peoples at the workplace?
Well, I think Kelly framed it accurately. One of the problems, though, is when we go through the process, there used to be a tribunal. You could complain, go to the Human Rights Commission, and seek a remedy that way. Now they actually want us to go to a grievance process. Although timelines aren't the same as a regular grievance in federal public service, where we would normally have you know, so many days to file the grievance once we became aware of what occurred, and then so forth. They give us 1 year to file those grievances. The problem is the process re-victimizes the individual going through that long, arduous process of seeking a remedy. And I think Kelly was accurate when he says, you know, it really takes many, many years before a person will feel whole again. And so that's the difficult part.
Right.
What we try to do is we try to be more proactive. We get involved in union management consultation committees. We insist on them being instituted in any workplace over 100 members. And we try and, you know, bring people that we know are outspoken and have, you know, been affected to the table, and try and provide that perspective to the employer so that they understand what the impacts of their particular policies are on those groups. So I think diversity committees or other committees that focus on equity within the workplace and deal with harassment, discrimination, all those other elements that come out of an organization that has those built-in systemic barriers, I think is a key to creating a different and healthy culture within the workplace.
Something that's ongoing for this long-term process. Thank you. Bronwyn, I will be asking you to share with us any tips you might have about how these orders get successfully enforced. But before I do that, I want to alert the listening audience that I am now going to be opening the phone lines, or they will be open very shortly, to take questions for our speakers on any of the issues that have been dealt with so far. Or my apologies that we're running a little bit behind, but this is a very dense area of information that we do need to get through. I do know that Senator Sinclair had to leave us, but we do have our other three experts here. So here are the instructions. To get into the electronic queue, all you have to do is push *1. You can do that now. And in a couple of minutes, following Bronwyn's response, I will start calling on audience members by your order in the queue. If you wish at any point to log out of the queue, press the pound key. So Bronwyn, what do you have any suggestions, tips about how people might be able to implement effective systemic remedies?
In the interest of time, I'll be fairly quick because I do agree with what Michael and Kelly have both said. I especially like Michael's priority on sort of prevention, things like the union management consultation committees, things like staff, employee committees, and certainly that's a model that we have used a lot in the Northwest Territories in terms of getting input from the people who are likely to be affected, who could be affected. I think Michael's emphasis on prevention rather than subsequent intervention is really, really important, because what both gentlemen said was that the impact on victims takes years and years, if ever, to really heal. So prevention becomes critical. And so, you know, in one of the things that, you know, one of the models that we have used a lot is sort of the basic principle of nothing about us without us. So going to Indigenous employees before we introduce principles, introduce policies or programs, having people involved in the development of the programs and policies that are going to affect them, I think can make a huge difference. So I'll keep quiet now.
That's fair. Thank you for getting that in. That was very helpful. So we do have a question from Sayuya from Tuazone. Sorry, my apologies. And could you go ahead with your question, please?
Hi. There's a group of us listening from Tawasin First Nation in British Columbia. It's Tom McCarthy here. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer. Thank you for all the useful information. My question is for Bronwyn. In the Northwest Territories, is there an issue in the public service where there's a difference in the number of Aboriginal people in senior versus junior positions? Meaning, is the bulk of the Aboriginal people, is there a disproportionate amount hired into less senior positions? And is the bulk of your senior management non-Aboriginal, does that create issues or perceptions of inequity or discrimination? And how are you actively working to deal with that in the Northwest Territories?
Thank you for the question. And the answer is yes. There is a disproportionate number of Indigenous employees in the sort of entry-level and lower-level positions, that there are fewer in senior management, although at the deputy level, this has increased fairly significantly over the last few years. But in those that sort of general senior management cadre is not as representative of Indigenous population. We're very, very aware of this. This is something which we are working on. One of the issues that sort of confounds it a bit is that if we bring people in at the lower level, then provide training, development opportunities that they take advantage of, the chances are that they would be offered positions at a senior level in a different organization, maybe in one of the private sector companies, especially when the mines were more active here in Aboriginal governments. And so they leave us. But what we are doing is we are initiating mentoring programs. We're looking at, we have an Aboriginal management development program, which is specifically geared to Aboriginal employees. And in this program, we identify people at the lower ranks, bring them in, give them 2 or 3 years training, and they guaranteed a position at the end, a senior management position at the end. This is slow because it's one by one. We are also working with a committee that we have on the Aboriginal Employees Advisory Committee, and we are looking at changing the management program to be able to accommodate more people. But it's sort of, there is a lot to be done. Working sort of one employee at a time, giving them ensuring they have the opportunities, providing mentors and training and development opportunities. We also have a program whereby it's called the Regional Recruitment Program, where recruitment is restricted to people from a certain region or community, which in our case are Aboriginal regions and communities. And so we can bring people into that, into a position, it may be a senior level, who are not fully qualified but could become qualified within a year. So there are various approaches that we're using.
Thank you for the question and for that answer, Bronwyn. The next section of materials addresses efforts that have been made to improve workplace equality for Aboriginal peoples. It's listed as Section 4, and it's found on pages 105 to 156 of your materials. Michael, can you help us understand what has happened with affirmative action programs which encourage the hiring and promotion of Indigenous peoples? Are they now viewed as being discriminatory? And what disadvantages do Indigenous applicants face in hiring and promotion processes? What might prevent this, such as education, training, mentoring programs?
Yes, and this is an ongoing debate and a difficult question to answer. I think when we look at the Employment Equity Act, you know, this is the 30th year of its existence. And although recently the governments have claimed that we've met representation in all four categories, although the previous question, which addressed the idea of our Indigenous employee base existing at lower level and entry level positions, my view on the affirmative action that's taken through that act is that if you bring people into an organization where the culture has all these biases about an individual or a group of individuals, it doesn't matter what you do, they're not going to succeed. We need to, if we're going to take affirmative action, the action should be built into the policy framework that governs the employees at work and supports the enabling of a culture that's inclusive and allows people to flourish and to, excel. If people are, bring them into the workplace and they're in fear of an inability to live up to a performance standard that they're being measured against, and they know that they're not supported by individuals around them, it's going to be very difficult to have them succeed. I think affirmative action is, I've heard the term reverse racism and reverse discrimination. There's no reverse about it. If it's racist, it's racist. If it's discriminatory, it's discriminatory. And I think, the sooner we all understand that these generational impacts that Senator Sinclair described for us, seven generations of impacts, and I've watched the videos. I've read most of the document. I've read, I've at least read the summary and all the calls to action. If we don't intervene in some way, we're never going to get there. So although there's a school of thought that maybe the time for affirmative action is past, I think we still need to find ways to build those into our processes, into the policy frameworks, and into how we govern our labor force in Canada.
Could you give us an example, perhaps, of some of the specific disadvantages that you've seen Indigenous applicants facing when they're trying to get hired or promoted?
Well, in our unit, we do a paperboard exercise, which requires about 30 to 35 or 40 pages of describing experiences in the workplace. You need to have specific experiences in order to move up the chain of command. And in many cases, if you're not given those opportunities to develop those experiences, you're not going to make it. Mm-hmm. And I see that all the time. We just don't provide those opportunities equitably within the departments. Now, I've seen a lot of improvements in the last 15 years since I've been involved with the union and since I've been involved with our diversity committees, and I think those positive, like providing those positive opportunities for the department to take steps to eliminate some of those barriers has been an improvement, and I think that's probably the best investment we can make, is to be proactive and try and work with departments to eliminate those barriers, develop best management practices. You know, I think the biggest thing we need to do, and quite correctly, is to provide educational and training. I think mentoring is a huge opportunity for us that we've missed. Most people don't have time to mentor because it's, you know, we're so overtasked as it is now. But I think it's important to think about it in terms of a long-term investment.
Right.
Mentoring, job shadowing, all those types of opportunities are what we should be focusing on. And eliminating the barriers, you know, I mean, just the hiring practices that we have now need to be reviewed. And I think an analysis of the existing policy framework needs to be done in order to, if we want to bring UNDRIP and Bill C-262 to the forefront and actually make it meaningful in the workplace for Indigenous employees, then we have to get rid of the regressive legislation of the past and look at more progressive policy frameworks.
Thanks, Michael. Bronwyn, what's been your experience with the success or non-success of affirmative action programs in encouraging the hiring and promotion of Aboriginal peoples? I know, based upon the question from the speaker or from the questionnaire last time, you've given us some of this, but is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, I think I have given it, and you know, I agree very much with what Michael had to say in terms of, you know, looking at the practices, looking at the, you know, the underlying legislation and principles. But and I really, really liked his emphasis on mentoring, because I think this is something that really can work if it's done, you know, if it's done well. It's a very powerful technique. I think that our experience with affirmative action is that it's, you know, it's been more successful, not successful enough. We have not met our targets, but it has been more successful bringing people in at the lower levels, like I referenced in the answer to the question. And so what we really have to focus on is how we can apply the affirmative action more effectively in development and training and promotional practices, which are bit more tricky, and they're less obvious, but certainly we are, you know, we're working on it.
Thank you very much. Kelly, anything to add from your experiences?
I'll be brief. Just two key messages, I guess, on the comments that the other presenters already spoke about. A lot of people don't use the word or the term affirmative action anymore, so I guess I would call special action and employment equity programs are an integral part of human rights law and policy, and they are allowed under the CHRAs. As stated in the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Concept and Practice and Special Action on Employment Equity Programs are grounded in the state's obligation to eliminate disadvantage caused by past and current discriminatory laws, traditions and practices, and represent a means to accelerate the achievement of equality between members of a particular target group and the rest of society. So those are the only two comments I'd add to, based on what the other two already spoken about.
Thanks very much, Kelly. Michael, what are some strategies for removing the barriers from Indigenous people's full participation in the workplace? What can be done through the collective agreement process? You started a bit to mention this earlier. I was going to get you to fill it out a bit.
Yeah, I think a big part of how we challenge some of these, you know, and I guess we're, you know, in Kelly's area of expertise, when it gets to the point where we actually have to challenge the process or challenge the, you know, the law or challenge, you know, whether or not it meets the collective agreement. And when I go through all the different cases that you've presented in the materials, what I find is there's a conflict between the collective agreement and the actual legislative framework that was in place to provide the opportunity for the affirmative action. So I think the biggest thing we can do is we need to harmonize the collective agreements in terms of what the current legislation says, Employment Equity Act, Canadian Human Rights Act. Those collective agreements need to basically embrace the enabling pieces of those legislation so that we can make sure that we've got a workforce that understands that this is built into our agreement with the employer, and that the employer and the union can work to make sure that that collective agreement's respected in a way that enables equity to happen. It has to be a cultural thing. I really believe that forcing equity to happen creates resentment in a workplace, and it doesn't end up giving you the positive outcomes that you're looking for. So we need to build, if it's in the collective agreement, now, and I know that sounds a little contrary, so we've got the framework, we've got the legislation, and we've built it into the collective agreement. I think if we do it on a negotiated basis and we all agree to it as a group, both the employer and the workers, I think it's embraced, and I think we can go from there. There's a whole suite of, in appendix, on 147, there's a whole suite of barriers and best practices. When I look at that, I think, wow, that's all we've developed over how many years of affirmative actions and employment equity? I just don't think that that's a very comprehensive list of barriers and best practices. I think we really can do a lot better than that, and I think organizations need to pull together and share more. So we need a common SharePoint for what we can do to make things better.
Thank you, Michael. Bronwyn, any further suggestions or comments about Michael's summary? What strategies have you seen that are effective? Bronwyn?
I'm sorry, I had muted myself. I agree with Michael's assessment, and that this is not something that you can force, that affirmative action, if it's not in the collective agreement, if it's not negotiated, if it's not mutually agreed to, if it's forced in any way, it causes huge resentment. And so certainly involving employees in development, not so much of the policy, but in terms of practice, what does it really mean in practice, and how do you apply it? I think that certainly looking at the systemic barriers, Michael's point about the appendix, it's an interesting start, but it's certainly not comprehensive by any stretch. I think that the affirmative action policies in and of themselves are very limited in their effectiveness. And
right.
we really have to look at the systemic barriers.
Thank you. Kelly, what strategies have you seen that have been either effective or some that don't seem to work?
A cross-cultural dialogue and the development of a collaborative relationship can promote mutual understanding. Employers can learn about the culture, the history, the values, the beliefs of the Indigenous peoples, and provide training within their organizations. Employers can integrate Indigenous peoples' issues into their processes and or operational activities and programs, and assign resources and implement Aboriginal employment initiatives into the business planning processes. I think they can also, during the hiring process, employers may consider being more flexible and consider all relevant work and life experiences and training that are related to the job that's going to be required to do by the worker.
Very efficient. Thank you, Kelly. I'm going to go into our final area that we're covering today, which is professional development and training. It's Section 5 in the materials, pages 157 to 174. Bronwyn, what obligation do employers in both the public and private sectors have under the existing human rights legislation to train staff, especially managers, in intercultural competency, conflict resolution, human rights, and anti-racism? And what, if anything, must employers do beyond their current legal obligation to implement the TRC's calls to action for training and professional development?
Certainly as employers, we're responsible for ensuring that we're providing environments that are free from any kind of racial discrimination or harassment, and to ensure that our policies and our activities, our programs, don't result in any sort of systemic discrimination, which means that we have to have people in the workforce who, especially managers, who are trained, who understand the issues, who do recognize discriminatory behavior when they see it and can prevent it, even beyond reacting to issues when they arise. We need to have people who are able to create an environment that supports real, true representation, that requires reflects true inclusiveness, and is responsive to diversity in the workplace. I think it's very easy to assume that we know it all. We know about residential schools. But there is, I think if you listen to Maurice Sinclair, we realize that even though we think we know, there is so much there that we don't know, which makes the obligation on employers to ensure training is available. It's difficult to force training, but, certainly in the Northwest Territories, we do have cross-cultural training, which is mandatory for all employees. It doesn't go anywhere near far enough, but it is a good start. I think beyond the legal obligation to provide a discrimination-free workplace, we have a ethical, maybe moral obligation to ensure that our workplaces are truly welcoming to all people. We have an obligation to ensure that people are treated equally, in the way, not so much that we treat them the same, but we treat them according to their needs and their aspirations. I recognize that we're short on time, so maybe I'll just stop there.
Well, that is much. You put a lot into that period of time, so thank you very much. Michael, do you see employers fulfilling these obligations? If not, have you seen what consequences are arising, and what further steps can you, as Bronwyn said, quickly give us in terms of what further steps need to be taken?
Well, I want to thank Bronwyn for those comments, because it really is a good segue into my comments now. When we look at our obligation to do the right thing, when we look at the Canadian Human Rights Act and the Employment Equity Act and the collective agreements, those are the minimum standard expected of an employer in this country. We don't need to just do the minimum. If an employer wants to hold itself out as an employee that has got a culture that's attractive to different demographic groups, in particular we're dealing with Indigenous folks now, then why would they not go over and above what the minimum standard is required by law? I think some employers that just take that approach, that we're going to go by the numbers and we're going to take that minimum approach, they automatically disconnect with the membership that's seeking to be treated equally. I think we need to do more. And I see in some cases, in particular, and I want to highlight my own department, particularly the unit that I work in, the Conservation and Protection Branch, for taking extra steps to do outreach with Indigenous communities on the West Coast. We do pulling together journeys with where we buy canoes. We actually go out and we paddle with folks on 2-, 3-, 5-day journeys. We do dream catchers where we bring Aboriginal youth together to talk about the relevance of employment in federal public service jobs, which protect the environment, protect fishery resources, forestry resources, parks, and we try and engage those communities in a way that develops and builds the relationship and shows that we're an organization that values Indigenous communities, and we want to bring Indigenous communities into our workplace and be part of our workforce so that we have that perspective. First Nation communities, particularly in the coastal areas, are a large part of our client base, and we need to have that perspective within our organization so that we can deal effectively outside the organization when we engage our clients. And I think when organizations take that approach, they become an attractive place for people to target for employment.
Thanks, Michael. Kelly, what else do employers have to do to implement the Commission's calls to action for training and development?
Move forward. it's out there. It's been out there for a while. I mean, this is something that should be settled to, or should be a surprise to them. They actually have to take action. They have to actually have people in place that actually believe in what they're going to be asked to do and are knowledgeable and culturally competent. And if they don't have those people that are culturally competent and not willing to actually put those plans in place, then I think the employer, the upper management, because it all starts with upper management, I think they have to take a look at their organization and the attitude of the organization, because it's going to be reflected on all the employees, and make adjustments. So I think that, you know, in general terms, I think that you have to be proactive as an employer, and you have to make sure that you're, I guess, being, you know, at the forefront of your industry and making sure that you're doing what's best for your employees, and you're trying to follow the calls to action that Senator Sinclair spoke about and which the other panelists have already touched on as well.
Thanks very much, Kelly. Bronwyn, give us some examples of the consequences for employers if managers are not adequately trained to deal with racism and harassment against Indigenous employees.
Well, once you get beyond the legal ramifications, that, you know, if you have incidents of, you know, discrimination, then, you know, there are penalties, both financial and other, that can be imposed. But beyond that, I think we risk a dysfunctional workplace, possibly even a toxic workplace, because people cannot work together effectively, because people are undermining one another. You lose employees because they become discouraged. If Indigenous or any employee feels that they are being somehow not given the opportunities that they need, that they're not being recognized, that they're being treated poorly, they'll leave, or they will continue to undermine the organization. It's very dangerous if you don't have adequately trained managers who can deal with people, because it risks really wasting human capital, which is, I hate that expression, but it risks wasting people, and that's unforgivable.
Thanks. Kelly, any thoughts to add?
Just a couple. I mean, the employers are responsible for the actions of their employees under vicarious liability in Section 65 of the CHRA. But a lot of it's common sense, too. So, you know, I'll just echo the comments that she already made. I know we're almost out of time, and I think you might have another question-and-answer session, so I'll limit my comments there.
All right. Thank you. And Michael, in a moment, I'll be giving you the chance if you want to add anything. But in the meantime, I want to alert the audience that, yes, we're coming very close to the end of the session. For those of you who can and wish to stay on the line, we will stay here for a few minutes longer. But right now, I'm going to open the phone lines again to answer your questions, if you have any for our speakers on these topics. And again, a reminder, all you have to do to get in the electronic queue is push *1. Please do that now, and I will start calling on any questioners by your order in the queue. To log out of the queue, press the pound key. Michael, back to you. Some of the potential consequences for employers.
I think some of the potential consequences have already been mentioned. It's, you know, I've seen in the workplace, if you don't have engaged employees that respect each other, you're not going to get much in the way of production out of them. They're just, you end up with a toxic workplace, and you end up bringing in conflict resolution processes, you end up bringing in all sorts of anti-harassment initiatives. And at the end of the day, we should be teaching respectful workplaces and stop reinforcing those negative things like harassment. union has taken the step to, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, we have our National Aboriginal People's Circle. Every member in our organization, 175,000 members, pays 11 cents per month per member to support the initiatives of that group, a small group of 14, which networks out into the regions. That is an endorsement by the membership that we support your issues and we support you in a way that gets some traction. We have respectful workplace committees. We try and promote these things in the workplace to get rid of those toxic environments and get rid of, you know, the idea that bullying is okay in the workplace. When in my workplace, no such thing.
Okay. So you have the trainings happen, and you aren't facing all these consequences. We don't have questions, and I'm conscious of the fact that it is time to wrap up, so I wish to proceed with some closing remarks. Let me run through a couple of housekeeping matters with you. First, for those of you who would be interested, you'll find the professional biographies of all today's panelists on the Lancaster House website. Secondly, if you haven't already done so, please be sure to download the materials at the link provided in the dial-in instructions email that was sent to you by Lancaster House prior to the call. Third, please fill out the survey for this audio conference, which can be found through a link on the dial-in instructions email. Anyone listening can answer the survey and have a chance to win a free audio conference registration for the upcoming audio series. Fourth, more information on upcoming Lancaster audio conferences and registration forms can be found on the website. The next audio conference is Conduct Gone Viral, Private Behavior, Public Reaction, and Workplace Consequences, and this is going to be held on Thursday, July 14th, 12:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Fifth, for the human resource professionals who wish to claim the professional development hours, please note this program has been approved for 1.5 continuing professional development hours under Section A3 of the Recertification Log of the Human Resource Professionals Association. I'm going to give you the number now to note. The HRPA program ID number is 201441. So that's 201441. For the BC Human Resource Management Association certification, it's the same event number. And the ID number for them is LH04046012. So LH04046012. And finally, I wish to thank all of you for listening, and I want to offer a special thanks to our panelists who did such a great job today, Senator Murray Sinclair, Michael Ballard, Kelly Serba, and Bronwyn Waters have done a great job, and you've earned our grateful thanks. Until next time, goodbye, and thanks you all to our listening audience.